Hi, and welcome to our very, very first episode of the Entrepreneurs Podcast with Peter Christo. So I've got to warn you, this is our first one, and there is a light echo when Peter Long, our guest, is speaking. I apologize for that. I've resolved that on the next one, but unfortunately, we had already taken it twice, and I didn't want to go again. So if you'd please bear with me. These are just little teething problems, and I hope you enjoy it. Peter is a really, really great guy, very supportive fellow. I've known him for probably 15-odd years, both as an investor, as an entrepreneur in a business that he set up called Lockbox, and he was also a big advocate of the ecosystem, particularly back in the days when we were doing Pitch Club. So he's a really down-to-earth and intelligent man. And I invite you to listen to his story. Thank you. Okay, here we go. All right, welcome Peter Long.
Thank you, Peter Christo. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't even begin to describe the technical challenges and the place that sound engineers must have. These are not simple software to control for two mics, on especially on the Mac. So thank you for your help.
Don't you know, just plug and play? Isn't that what Steve Jobs said?
Well, that's right. That's right. I actually remember working for Hewlett Packard when I was just straight out of uni, and there was the Mac guy who was there, and he said, "Oh, Macs always work really well. They just plug and play." Well, guess what?
Seemingly they are plug and play. So there you go.
Yeah, that's too right. Funny. Look, thanks for agreeing to do this. We had a little crack at it the other day, which was a delightful conversation. So look, you know, we're kind of finding our way with this podcast, as I said to you, and I really enjoyed our conversation the other day. But I think that maybe we start off with a little bit of an intro from you, just kind of give the listeners a little bit of an idea of who you are, and then I'll try and wrestle you where I want to go, and you can try and move to where you want to go in the conversation. But thanks for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. So I've had kind of an interesting career. I started back in the computer world back at Melbourne University. And what I subsequently learned was I was actually in the first class they offered in the new department of computer science.
Oh, okay.
So they just hired a guy called Professor Peter Poole from ANU come down. He was the inaugural computer science professor. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, as new students, we had no idea. We thought, oh, this looks like cool stuff. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we were in the first year of the first time that the University of Melbourne had offered computer science.
Okay. And that was, should we say, the years?
It was last century, say that.
Yeah, that's right. We're probably dinosaurs at the distance, so still chewing away on leaves.
And what was interesting, so the university was a bit confused as to where to put this department.
Oh, okay.
So because it was called computer science, they put it in science. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, it's moved to engineering, which is kind of more in line with other universities around the world. So that was really interesting. And turned out the course was very popular. And again, subsequently I learned that Peter Poole had to go and argue with the dean to really make sure that there was no... Sorry, what's the matter?
No, nothing. It's all good. Okay. I'm just checking that the battery's still connected, that the power's still tuning through.
You know, his courses became so popular that the other heads of department were getting angsty about this.
And
they were going to the dean and going, hang on, you need to put quotas on these computer science guys because they're stealing students from physics and chemistry and other stuff. And Peter Poole had to go into bat and go, no, this is, you know, this is supply and demand. This is what the students are interested in. You know, there shouldn't be any quotas on, you know, doing computer science.
Right. And who won that battle?
He did.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I graduated with an honours degree from University of Melbourne in science, majoring in computer science.
Nice. Right.
And then from then, you know, kind of more traditional career path, I worked for one of the universities for a few years because that was kind of fun and they were at leading edge.
Yep.
From there, I went into industry. I worked for a IT reseller. So this was, another interesting company. It was founded by an Australian called Peter Jones, who'd spent time in the US.
Right.
And moving back to Australia, he wanted to kind of bring some of that back. So he set up distribution arrangements with his mates. So this company, you know, sold all kinds of different stuff. And that was my first introduction to computer networking, because a couple of the products were innovative in the computer networking sphere.
Yep.
Back before Ethernet was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are talking last century.
Yeah, okay.
And then from there, I ended up at Telstra as a contractor. And again, this was very early days for networking.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent a huge amount of Telstra's money building a corporate network that connected every data center, every business office, and every telephone exchange into a consistent IP and IPX network.
Wow.
So again, this was a massive undertaking, and introduced me to a company called Cisco Systems, whose products we ended up installing. At one stage, Telstra was Cisco's fifth largest customer in the world.
Wow.
So we certainly had the attention of the people back in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that, and I think I was a sufficient pain in their side, pointing out the deficiencies of their product and so forth, that I got a phone call one day and said, am I interested in interviewing for a job at Cisco? And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Yes, I could do this.
Mm.
And it turned out this job was actually based in San Jose in California.
Right.
So I said to them, yep, I can do that if you can fly me over and back before Christmas. I've got time to...
So was that because, and I've got to ask this, was that because you didn't know the way to San Jose?
Apparently you get on an airplane.
So I'm trying to remember with San Jose, because there's San Jose and there's San Jose. So
this is San Jose, California. It's about 50 miles or 80 kilometers south of San Francisco.
Right, okay. So is that, and that's down towards the valley,
It is in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Yep.
So kind of Silicon Valley starts.
Yep.
You know, Palo Alto, that's kind of where Stanford and things are. And then further south into Cupertino, where Apple is, and then San Jose, where many other companies existed. So So I went over, I got interviewed, and I think even before I got home again, there was a job offer sitting on the table. So
right, fantastic.
Saying come.
Wow. So I guess, you know, what I'm hearing is that... you know, the traditional sort of career path, but obviously very much an engineering tech head, you know, propeller on top of the head, which suits you very well, as I've, you know, known you for many years now.
Actually, I'm going to pull you up on that point, because, you know, while it does sound like a traditional tech head approach, one of the things I did while I was contracting at Telstra was I went back to Monash University and completed an MBA degree.
Back then. Oh, wow. Okay.
And really the two choices in town, well, there are three choices in town. You go to RMIT, you go to Melbourne Uni, or go to Monash.
Yep.
problem with the Melbourne Uni course was, apart from being ridiculously expensive, it was full time. And I wasn't about to stop working for a whole year to do an MBA. So Monash offered a part-time MBA, which normally would be 4 years. I did it in three. Because they did some acceleration. And so as a result, I could keep working, and at the same time, I could study for my MBA.
Okay. So, but let me pull you up a little bit on it. So in my little brain, if you've done a business degree and you've done a, you know, business MBA, and you've done a technical degree in your computer science degree, and then you found yourself in the heartland of the entrepreneurial world in Silicon Valley.
Well, in fact, it was because I had an MBA and I was a techie.
Right.
Was
that
why
got you
I
there.
Got the job.
But Cisco. You got the job. But I guess where I was going to, this being an entrepreneurial type podcast, is that where you got infected with the bug in terms of, I want to play? Because you can do an MBA and go and get a job.
You can. And, you know, I think... the opportunity that Cisco really gave everybody in the early days was just to be at the coalface of a lot of creation, a lot of innovation, and a lot of firsts.
Right.
And secondly, because of where it was, you were exposed to innovators and entrepreneurial type people.
Mm-hmm.
Cisco at the time was, you know, acquiring companies at a great rate, and so we got to, you know, I did due diligence on a couple of those companies and got to kind of talk firsthand with the entrepreneurs who were being acquired.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, also some of the people at Stanford who were being very innovative and creating products that Cisco acquired. Mm. I got to meet some of those people. So, you know, entrepreneurship was kind of in the air big time. And particularly during that period where there was, you know, prior to the dot-com crash and so forth, there was a lot of people doing some very exciting things. And so it was hard to kind of avoid that kind of vibe.
Can you comment on the contrast between coming from little old Australia, which was probably sub 20 million people at that time, and kind of the culture in the US?
So I think the reason why Australians got hired a lot into places like Cisco then is that we were very good at doing lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just new. That was just the nature of where we were. Mm. We were remote. We had to be self-sufficient and resilient. In the US, you noticed people were much more siloed.
Mm.
They had one role and they really didn't know much outside of their role.
Yeah.
So that was kind of an interesting perspective on what was going on over there.
I actually bumped into that myself when I was in the military. So we would do operations with the Yanks up in far north Queensland. And I found out that my job as a radio operator back in those days was six people's job. So there was a guy to set up antennas. There was a receiver of Morse code, a sender of Morse code, which shows my age. You know, there was somebody to run the generators. I can't remember the other two. Like, but you know, there was somebody to do VHF, somebody to do HF. You know, it was
very bizarre.
Okay, yeah. Wow. You know, what are they doing the other? The rest of the day, sitting there drinking coffee. But you've got 300 plus million people versus little old Australia.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that was really quite distinctive was, you know, the Silicon Valley ecosystem is just something that was very unique.
Mm.
So yes, everyone was siloed, but what it means is you had people who were very, very good at
specific
doing things.
Yep.
So if you wanted to build a technology company, you could find the best software engineers, you'd find the best hardware engineers, you could find the best IC designers, you could find the best guys to package it and the best guys to sell it.
Mm.
And so as a result, you know, kind of success bred success.
Yeah.
And so it was a perfect place for the entrepreneurs to create businesses. Because they knew they could, if it was a good idea and it had really good product market fit, then you could attract the right people and people would have those skills you need to be successful. And I think, you know, compared to Australia at the time where, you know, I wouldn't say jack of all trades, master of none kind of philosophy, but, you know, we tended to do everything. And so if you wanted to find someone that did IC design, for example, in Australia, really hard.
Yeah, sure. So, but would you agree that there was a point at which you drank the Kool-Aid of, you know, I want to play in the entrepreneurial world? Because some people, I guess, have, you know, parents who are entrepreneurs and all that sort of thing, or they kind of, you know, they get to a point in their career that they think this is something that has always been burning inside me. Was the need to go off and be I guess a founder? I guess is that having an entrepreneurial nature, and you can have that within a corporation, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You can want to be an entrepreneur, but you know, you've got no skills, right? So it's aspirational. Or you can, you know, I guess you can acknowledge that within your character, within your DNA, and then use the skills that you've got and you've acquired to go off and actually execute that. Was there a transition point for you, or did you always think that you would inevitably do something that's a little bit creative, or was it always there?
I think it's always there. I think there wasn't like a defining moment. It seemed like there was just a slow transition in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Before I came back to Australia, I worked for a couple of startups in the US.
Okay.
And got exposed to fundraising, got exposed to kind of the nuts and bolts side of, you know, in that startup world.
Yeah.
And then came back to Australia for mostly family reasons, thinking, do I want to get a job?
Yep.
Or do I want to go do something kind of, you know, based on all the things that I know and I've learned?
Did you?
And so I really didn't actually go looking for jobs. I end up kind of continuing that journey, as it were, towards, you know, what's something that looks like a really interesting problem to be solved, looks something that, you know, from the research appears to be a problem in the marketplace and can we go do something about it?
Yeah, okay.
And so as a result, I did probably continue that journey into the entrepreneurial world.
Yeah, okay. So did you have to bring your wife along for the ride? Did she have to buy in, or you just said, look, I'll do whatever I do?
She was fine with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, she wasn't really saying, you got to go get a job or, no, you shouldn't do the startup. She was always been supportive. And that's, I think that's a great help because, you know, there's been a lot of research into the stress of being an entrepreneur, particularly in a place like Australia, and having, you know, solid family support, someone who's going to support you when you go home at night, I think is hugely important in terms of being, you know, making forward progress.
I can attest to that. I can, but this is not about me. So maybe sort of going back to, so culturally, you've probably, so you got back in the mid-2000s. So what you saw before in Australia, what you experienced in the eye of the tornado in Silicon Valley, and then coming back, and then I guess over the last 15, 20 years, what's been happening in Australia, maybe talk a little bit about what you've seen that's changed. Because we met during Pitch Club days back in 07, I think it was.
So, you know, we went through a fundraising process with the startup here in Australia. And at that time, there were very few institutional investors, and we call them VCs or angel funds or whatever else. There were very few. There was a, like in Melbourne, there was Melbourne Angels and maybe three or four VCs.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember there was
Starfish
Melbourne Angels.
And Jolimont. And
I've still got them on my phone.
And in Sydney, you know, Southern Cross, you know, and during the period between then and now, you've seen those kind of really mushroom into a whole plethora of things. You know, Bill Barty, who was one of the partners at Southern Cross, has gone on to do, you know, amazing things with Blackbird and, you know, some of the other funds. So as a result, you know, you've kind of seen a mushrooming. And I think partly because people have gone, actually, Australians can go build these things and have world-class products. And we've seen that with Atlassian and Canva and other people like that. Also, Aconex in the construction business, Lee Jesper and Rob Philpott. So as a result, you know, you've kind of seen this blossoming. And so now, to some degree, there's a lot of opportunity to find VCs. Now, it's still hard to pitch to them, and they're still only going to do, you know,
well, they've each got their wheelhouse. They've got their area, you know.
They only do five or six investments a year, but... to your point, they're much more focused. So I'm familiar with funds that look at, for example, university technology, you know, picking the things that are going to do well out of those and commercializing them. You've got Main Sequence working with Syro. You've got other people, like there's some Sydney firms that only work with B2B SaaS models.
Right.
And so, you know, if you know what you're doing, where your opportunity is, then you know, you can go talk to them because then they go, well, this is what we're interested in, let's see if you've got a business. So so to answer your question, the last 10-15 years has just been, I think, a very mushrooming of both, you know, entrepreneurs and the funding. And so I think that's really added to the entrepreneurial ecosystem here.
And do you know if the money's come from you know, the institutions, is that external capital that's coming into Australia to fund these, or is it just our institutions are exposing part of their portfolio into the more, you know, further up along the risk curve?
Yeah, when I said institutions, I just meant VCs firms. How are the VCs firms funded? Widely. You know, some of them are getting money from the universities and superannuation funds and so forth like that. Some of them are government funded. Some of them are just funded by high net worth individuals who are looking for portfolio diversification. And things like the angel groups, you know, they're just mostly individuals, but, you know, they're not committing millions and millions of dollars to a fund. They're putting in, you know, 10, 15K or something like that.
And it sounds like the high net worths, you know, traditionally they probably wouldn't be as active in you know, exposing their portfolio. They you know, they take more traditional approach here in Australia, at least.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, in Australia, which is kind of unique, is this idea of a self-managed super fund. So again, a lot of people who were probably doing well in life set up their own personal self-managed super funds, and as a result, they could make decisions to diversify that portfolio. So instead of just buying stocks, they could go, I'm going to put some of this into into an angel fund or an art or property or whatever. And so as a result, you know, those funds, the self-managed super funds, were able to also invest in the ecosystem.
Yeah,
so okay. I think that's probably uniquely Australian, but certainly, you know, in terms of the opportunities.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that needs to be said and kind of relates to what you know is the role of government here.
Mm.
And I'm going to look at two aspects of that.
Mm-hmm.
One is probably less well known is the opportunity for investors to get great tax breaks by investing in early stage funds.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain class of VCs that have gone through the hoops with the ATO.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an investor in those funds, you get a capital gains tax holiday for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And additionally, you get 10% of your investment back as a tax credit.
Awesome.
So it's like, okay, that sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So I get immediate 10% back, so I haven't lost all my money.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on the assumption that these guys know what they're doing, and these guys have a couple of good exits, then I'm not paying capital gains on that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really made it quite attractive for investors to invest into this space.
Okay.
And that's kind of interesting from a government perspective, because I don't know any other country that does that particularly.
Mm.
Maybe the Brits do it, I think.
Possibly.
But certainly the Americans aren't that generous.
No, that's right, they'll take.
And then I think the other aspect is obviously, you know, the whole set up around grants,
mm.
right? From export grants to commercialization grants to, you know, industry-specific grants, there's been a lot of assistance from the government to help people move forward.
So maybe that's a good segue into the venture that you did that I was a little bit involved in with Lockbox. Maybe talk about, you know, how that came about. You know, I know you went to the Accelerating Commercialization Program. How valuable was that for you, and what the journey was with regards to Lockbox?
So Lockbox was a zero-trust file transfer idea. It was probably a decade early.
Yeah, I'd agree
because
with
that. Because we actually need it now
yeah.
as opposed to a decade ago. And realistically, the majority of the customers back then who cared were in law enforcement and justice and people like that.
Mm.
Sort of the need for privacy hadn't really worked its way through into the public consciousness.
Well, we hadn't lost our privacy at that stage.
But also, you know, there was legislation requiring it.
Yep.
But as I was talking to one of my lawyer friends this week, she goes, I don't know anybody that's ever been prosecuted under the Privacy Act.
Right.
And if the government asks, what should we do more? It's like, well, actually enforce the laws you have would be a good start.
Yeah.
As a result, it didn't really find product market fit.
Mm.
But along the way, in terms of the funding journey, certainly the government was very helpful in terms of the Commercialization Australia grants, as they were then called, I think.
Yep.
They helped both hire a CTO,
mm-hmm.
because there was a experienced executive grant that we were able to tap into.
Yep.
And also just provide matching funding that we could go back to our investors and go, hey, here's a project plan. You know, it's a good idea for everybody and we need the money. You know, are you up for it?
Mm-hmm.
And so that process was good in just helping to refine what we were doing, why we were doing it, and mm-hmm. what the benefits were.
Yeah, sure.
And certainly the money was very helpful.
Yeah, okay. And in terms of then getting venture capital, did that help?
Yeah, so we had some early money in before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result of getting the grant, which, as you know, requires matching funding,
mm-hmm.
we were able to go back to our initial investors and said, you know, if you put money in as a follow-on,
mm-hmm.
it gets matched by the government. This is a really good it's a really good idea.
Yep.
So in fact, it was relatively straightforward to go back to the investors and say, can you give us matching funding? And I think without the grant, it would have been much harder to have had those conversations.
Okay. So clearly you've been exposed to, you know, the machinations of startups, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, good education, you know, good balance between business and tech. So what was lacking, if anything, when you were getting Lockbox going? So I guess the you know, was it a capability around marketing? Was it a capability around managing the team? Was it a capability around, you know, administering? Was it around R&D and kind of herding the cats? Because, you know, you're surrounding yourself with a lot of very smart people, Where were the challenges for you?
So there were obviously a number of challenges. One was we probably didn't do as good a job of really clarifying the product marketing fit at the beginning.
Okay.
There were lots of people who said, this is a good idea, and yes, I would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful book out called The Write It Now, which kind of really expounds this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the author of that book went through the same journey, which was lots of people are happy to say yes. You actually need to get proof in the form of cash from their pocket to actually decide whether they're actually going to make...
That's the money shot.
The money shot, right? Because... And the corollary of that is you really have to go out of your way to find people who don't like the idea.
Okay.
Who will go out of their way to say, this is a really stupid idea for the following reasons.
Right, okay.
And rather than just saying you're an idiot, you don't see the vision, you should sit down and listen to them and go, well, why do you think that?
Yeah.
And pick that apart a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some degree it's the write it problem. Again, people are always willing to go, oh, mate, that's great, you should do that. Whereas people aren't as willing to tell you why your baby's ugly.
Yeah, that's right. I guess I've seen this firsthand on a number of projects that I advise on with the AC program. So it's not just validating that the widget's going to work, validating that the pricing model's going to work, that the market that you're pitching to, the market fit is going to work. You know, so there. So all those need to be validated, not just that the this thing's green lights right across, fantastic, it's working, and somebody willing to stick their hand in their pocket, at least those first customers, you say, okay, we've got one cohort of customers that we can now scale. This we're going to have to probably move across into other segments, but with the evolving nature of our product, but at least we've got the first one right.
And we had some technology challenges as well, because we originally chose programming language which we felt had broad applicability, and it was one of these languages that ran on a number of different platforms, so we'd go, great, let's pick that rather than picking a platform specific language. Unfortunately, that language kind of quickly became persona non grata with a number of people in the industry, mostly due to the fact it had some security issues and other stuff. And as a result, we had to kind of obfuscate the fact we're using that by wrapping it back into native implementations again.
Right.
So, we probably lost some valuable time by making what seemed to be a right decision in terms of optimizing our engineering resources and not having a crystal ball that realized that actually this technology was going to go on the nose shortly and we shouldn't be using it.
So
that was kind of annoying, but I'm not sure how we could have addressed that sooner, to be honest.
I don't know, if some things you just can't afford. I guess that's why you need a forgiving strategy. Right, and that's really about runway.
And I think, the other problem was, to some degree we had based the market demand side of the operation on the basis of regulation and legislation.
Yeah, okay.
And both here and in the US, it was pretty apparent that while the letter and the spirit of the laws and regulations required the use of a product like we built, there was no enforcement.
Yeah, okay.
Either here or in the US. And so people go, well, no one really cares. Why would I bother?
Well, I guess that goes back...
And that kind of,
But that was that market. I mean, would it be fair to say that you could have sold it to law enforcement instead and just focus your energies there?
We could have, but again, there wasn't quite enough of them in the markets we were talking to.
Right, okay. Whereas now they're scrambling.
And again, back then, people, it was really just Department of Justice who cared, because they were worried about, the stuff that, was quite sensitive.
Yeah.
And they loved the fact we had a zero knowledge, zero trust.
Did they buy it?
They're a customer, yeah.
Right, okay.
But then, you go talk to, well, who else would care? Do the police care? They should care. They didn't.
Right.
And we've seen the failings of the police force in recent times in terms of data and approach to problem solving. So, again, culturally, they should have been all over this, but, historically and logistically, just wasn't the right time.
Yeah, okay.
And I think, if you look at what makes companies successful or not, a lot of it, when you really ask the entrepreneur what made them successful, and a lot of times it's good timing.
Oh, timing's imperative. It's okay to be a little bit early, but way too early. You're sitting there. A quarter of a century's got to pass before you're there. And if you're too late, then you're too late.
Yeah.
You know. So what advice would you give somebody starting out now who's sort of kind of, you know, making the leap into a new venture, particularly if they're operating in Australia?
I'm going to go back to the Write It, this book. I'll get the author for you.
Yep, I'll put it in the show notes.
That's it. He basically really hammers into the point of collecting your own personal data.
Right.
And not relying on hearsay or other people's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And he recommends you doing a number of almost before MVP, some basic trials to try and find out if anybody actually cares or not.
Yeah.
And he gave some great examples in his book. One was IBM thought that they should build a device that does automatic transcription for executives.
Right.
Because back then in the day, people recorded into dictaphones and then went down to the typing pool.
Yeah.
So they actually built a fake box.
Right.
Put it in some guys' offices. The fake box actually was just a pipe to a secretary in the next room who was typing.
Right. Oh, nice.
And they just wanted to see whether people would actually use it.
Yep.
And the feedback from that was they didn't like it.
All right. And why?
Just the human aspect or there's something new or whatever. And basically, instead of building this massive product, which would have been a complete failure, they ran this trial for a couple of months in different places and no one liked it. No one wanted it.
I think that's extraordinarily smart to do it that way. There was another use case where back in the 90s when, you know, the web was just appearing, internet, and that was, I can't remember who it was, but they were looking at selling a car. Can we sell a car online? Yeah. So rather than going off and building a big e-commerce, you know, they just set up a web page, put a photo of a BMW, a really nice BMW, and just put it, I think, for $5,000 less than the list price.
Right.
And then when they got an order, they got somebody put through, no, I want to buy it. All right. They basically went and bought one at list price and gave it to them at five. And so basically the experiment cost them $5,000.
Right. And it's those kind of things where you can actually test the market. And another example, you know, the book gave a hypothetical about running training on buses.
Yep.
So we talked about Silicon Valley before. A lot of the Silicon Valley businesses are down in the South Bay, in San Jose.
Yep.
A lot of people want to live in San Francisco because it's hip and cool.
Yep.
It's an hour commute.
I recall.
No one wants to sit on 101 for an hour.
Yep.
So Google and all these people rent buses.
Right.
Massive buses. And they just drive them up, pick up people in San Francisco and drive them down to the office.
Right.
And the buses have got Wi-Fi and comfy seats, and the guys sit there and
tap away.
And the idea was, well, could I run training classes on the bus? Right? These guys are sitting there for an hour on the bus.
Yeah, teach them something.
And so again, they just ran an experiment.
Yep.
Would you pay, you know, $50 or $250 for a 2-week course on the bus? And like you said, put up a web page, put up some courses.
Yeah.
See how many people signed up. And then if they actually found people signed up, they go find an instructor in the class.
Yeah. First.
But again, instead of building up some large, complicated idea and pitch decks and all the rest of it, they just went out and just found out if does anybody care.
Yeah, do the prototype version of it. I've got you know him, Ian McGregor, he's a business mentor. He says, you know, catch the hare first.
Yes.
Then worry about how you're going to cook it.
And so I think, you know, the advice is not to get stuck into the, you know, all the minutia and all the extra bits you got to do. You've really got to go and see if anybody cares.
Yep.
And if you're writing software, that might mean you have to build something that kind of looks like what you think it's going to do.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a bunch of, you know, don't look at the man behind the curtain.
String and chewy and masking tape and whatever it is.
Yeah, so, you know.
Just this all looks like it goes bing.
You know, like the order actually ends up on a fax machine that someone reads. You know, whatever. But the point is you actually want to test the market and put some prices out there and just see if anybody cares.
Yeah, yeah.
and I think that's the that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. Well, we might call it there. Thank you very, very much. I do believe you're going to be #001. We'll see how we go, and we'll have you back and as a more maybe a regular commentator as well.
So, well, it's been a pleasure. And-